Thank you, members of the court, counsel. This is the case of Baker Hesser versus the Department of Health and Human Services. And Mr. Domina, good morning to you. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
Not for the appellant, Your Honor.
Very good. Guitar, you have no questions? Okay, good morning again to each of you. And Mr. Domina, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I'm Dave Domina. I'm here on behalf of Dr. Natalie Baker and Stacy Worth Sweeney, two employees with different career paths by a considerable margin at the Lincoln Regional Center, both terminated the same day and each terminated by an unsigned letter. Dr. Baker was hired to clean up the Lincoln Regional Center because it had serious morale problems. She had a significant history as a state employee with the Department of Corrections and had distinguished herself there for her courage. She was hired because that was the commodity that was known to be needed in the position of medical director, which she assumed. Stacy Worth Sweeney spent 29 years of her life at the Lincoln Regional Center, and after she started at the lowest levels and worked her way up, after 10 years or so there, when the Lincoln Regional Center had a void in its non-medical staff leadership, she plugged it. She was the person called upon to step in to be the director, to run the services, to make sure that the hospital would function for the professional people. The Lincoln Regional Center takes care of the most ill persons in Nebraska, at least the most ill with mental health problems, and generally the most ill who pose problems to the criminal justice system. The people who work there frequently are called upon to appear in court, and they're required to have mental health assessments when they do. Those mental health assessments have to be current, or they're meaningless to courts. But Dr. Baker found when she got there that some of the psychiatrists were as far delinquent in their patient care notes and records as a year in recording their contacts with the people they were charged with taking care of. She insisted that change. She was supported by Ms. Sweeney. Now, Dr. Baker was required to insist that that change, not for the obvious and practical reason that it's tremendously dangerous not to, but also because the medical staff bylaws required it, the rules and regulations of the hospital required it, the formal regulations of the Department of Health and Human Services required it, and the regulations of the United States Department of Health and Human Services required it. She was the medical director of a licensed hospital. By definition, both a hospital and a psychiatric hospital under our statutes. It had to apply for that license. It had to be credentialed for that license on a regular basis, just like every other hospital. Her position involved the discharge of legal duties. When she was terminated, she was told, sort of, told more clearly after the fact in this litigation, that the rationale for her termination was that a lawyer not occupying a statutory position, not in the chain of command for Dr. Baker or the Department of Behavioral Health within the Department of HHS, had issued an order saying suspend personnel activity because Dr. Baker wanted the non-compliant psychiatrists fired. She'd warned them for 45 days after she got there, and they had not caught up in their records or attempted to do so and were obstructive. She continued to make that demand, insisting as close to 14 days before her termination that action be taken. She was charged with being uncooperative and not providing leadership because she didn't comply with this order issued by a lawyer without any authority to issue orders, an order that has never in the course of this litigation surfaced. And I dare say, I'll bet it doesn't surface this morning. There is no order. There is no authority for issuing an order. Dr. Baker in her deposition said she heard there was something. She never got it. She didn't even get an email from this lawyer. He didn't have authority to write one. But she had a duty to discharge her position's responsibilities. And she did. When she wouldn't get along and go along with the idea that we're not going to discipline the psychiatrist because it might throw our doctor to patient ratio off and jeopardize our federal funding if we miss that ratio, she said, patients first. I'll take care of the staffing ratio with locum tenens doctors, not these guys. Patients first. She was fired for it. And we're here asking you reverse and remand the judgment of the district court because there are profound and abundant issues of fact that require trial. If you look only at the response to the statement of disputed facts filed by the appellants in the district court, you'll see 118 paragraphs with approximately 60 or 70 of them conceded as disputed facts, and another 25 or 30 where there's a denial or an admission with a qualification.
Mr. Domina, you understand that just because a fact may be disputed doesn't necessarily prevent summary judgment. It has to be a material fact.
Understand that, Your Honor. So, and if we had an isolated one, I might agree with you that that rule might apply. But we don't have isolated disputed facts here. We have a lawyer who relied on some unsworn statements that he tried to summarize to justify firing Ms. Sweeney. We have the same lawyer who perceived a possibility that one of the recalcitrant, non-compliance, a better word, psychiatrists might sue the state claiming that he was being discriminated against for his national origin. In the very vast record before you, one person mentions national origin, and that's that lawyer who was charged with investigation. Neither of my clients anywhere in this record made any reference to the national origin of any physician or non-physician at the Lincoln Regional Center. There is no evidence of any discrimination except against us, and against us because we attempted to enforce the rules. We were engaged in a protected activity. We suffered employment injury, and the nexus between those two is abundantly clear. Under the Fair Employment Practices Act, we presented issues of fact, and we believe we're entitled to a trial. And because that statute defines the state along with employer and everybody else, we contend we're entitled to a trial before a jury. We think the trial court was wrong in those two regards.
You raised evidentiary issues as well. Do you want to discuss those?
Yes, Your Honor. I made a passing reference to them a moment ago, and I'll discuss them more. We objected to the offer of several exhibits, which were all in the nature of unsworn summaries of witness interviews by this investigating lawyer. The trial court held that those statements were not offered to prove the truth of the matters asserted. Well, there was no other reason to offer them, and they were the gist of what he relied upon for the termination recommendation. They were received and used for the truth that they purportedly expressed. They were hearsay, another ground for reversal. I'll save the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Todd, good morning to you, and my apologies if I'm pronouncing your name wrong.
You're good. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Heidi Guta, and I'm a partner at Baird Home Law Firm, and I represent the Appalachians, the state of Nebraska, and the Department of Health and Human Services. I'd like to begin with the plaintiffs made in their argument and in their brief some sweeping factual statements that are not in the record or either contradict the record. For example, Dr. Baker did not discover the delinquent record issue involving several of the psychiatrists. She was hired to help correct that issue. So it wasn't some big cover up that she discovered or anything like that. The record's well documented that the medical directors before her had also been dealing with that. She was hired to coach them and help fix that. Yet just weeks into her tenure there, she was insisting that they be fired. And rather than meeting with them repeatedly, giving them a chance to improve their record keeping skills. And so when she's insisting to fire two of the psychiatrists that are in a protected class, that is a red flag. She also knew she also admitted in her deposition that she knew of the directive by Bo Botello, that there were going to be no terminations until this investigation was complete. She admitted she knew that. And contrary to the record, Bo Botello was not just general counsel, even though I think as general counsel, he would have authority to issue that directive. He was chief operating officer directly under the CEO.
You said contrary to the record. Did you mean contrary to your opponent's argument?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Yes, contrary to my opponent's argument. Thank you. Yes, and it's well established in the record and undisputed that he was the chief operating officer and could give those directives. It's also undisputed that Grant Dugdale, who conducted the investigation, who was new to the department but had 30 years as a lawyer involved in investigations, especially for the state of Iowa, he wasn't duped by anybody. He wasn't involved in a cover-up. There's no evidence in the record to suggest that, as plaintiffs have in their briefs. The unsigned letter that the plaintiff's counsel mentioned as well, it was unsigned. It was a termination letter that was unsigned. However, it was given to each of the plaintiffs in person by their supervisor, Mark Lobachardier. And so there's no question that they knew that their supervisor was involved in the decision and was terminating their employment. Mr. Domina's argument reiterates the fact why we don't even get to the FIBA argument in this case, that this case, as Judge Ott held, should be dismissed simply on the basis because it does not state a cognizable claim under FIBA. Under the Wendell case, it's very clear that if a plaintiff is claiming that they engaged in affirmative duty to report or to do something, which the plaintiffs here repeatedly state in their briefs and in their argument, then that is a wrongful discharge in violation of public policy claim. That's not a FIPA claim, as Wendell separated and described. And so if it's a wrongful termination in violation of public policy claim, that's a tort, and that has to be first brought under the State Tort Claims Act. Well, first of all, here, plaintiffs dismissed that claim early in the case. And secondly, as the record is undisputed, there is no exhaustion of the State Tort Claims Act remedies. So we believe that on that basis alone, the FIBA claims could be dismissed. But even if you get past that and into the actual FIBA claims, we think that it's very clear that this was not a whistleblowing case. Whistleblowing case involves you have to be opposing or refusing to participate in unlawful, which has been defined as illegal activity. Failing to keep up with records is nowhere defined as unlawful or illegal. And so, especially here, where the Bond case says, if you're merely reporting something by coworkers or by subordinates, in this case for Dr. Baker, that also cannot be a whistleblowing type of claim. And just practical common sense says you can't be whistleblowing something that everybody knew about and that they were working to correct. Even if we get past that first prima facie element that the plaintiffs must prove that they engage in a protected activity, they have to show that there is a temporal connection between that activity and their terminations. And as we've set forth in our briefs, Sweeney's would expand several years and so far exceeds the temporal gap and actually refutes any showing of a temporal connection. And Baker, she began asking for them to be terminated in April. She was not herself terminated until June. And the cases we have cited, and it's been well established, that 1 to 2 month gap is not sufficient to prove that causal connection. Even assuming, for argument's sake, they could get past the prima facie elements, the burden then shifted to the state to produce a legitimate non-discriminatory reason. We've set forth in our brief, I won't reiterate here, you've seen the very thick in the record investigation by Mr. Dugdale. He did probably one of the most thorough investigations I've seen in an employment case, and that sets forth our legitimate non-discriminatory reason. Burden then shifts back to them to prove that that reason that the state gave was pretext, and there's no evidence of that here. There's no causal connection. There's no timing connection. It's well documented regarding the reasons for the termination. And there's no evidence that there was any lack of good faith. They relied on many, many witness interviews and engaged in a good faith investigation. The plaintiff's disagreement with that conclusion does not prove pretext. To follow up on the question regarding the witness statements, we believe the cases that we've cited establish that in Nebraska and other cases that specifically address it in the employment context, they repeatedly allow employment investigations to be considered because they are not offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. They're offered solely to show the state of mind of the listener, the non-retaliatory basis, and we believe they also fall under the business record exception as set forth in the cases we've cited.
The summaries in this case in a format that complies with the evidentiary requirements under summary judgment?
Yes, we believe so. They were authenticated. The summaries were authenticated by Mr. Dugdale. And there's no requirement that that a court reporter come in and be present for witness interviews in an employment investigation where we're not saying that everything, we're not saying that we're offering those to say everything in them is true. We're offering them to show only if we had a good faith basis to make the decision that we did. And so in that situation, the cases are pretty clear that that is an acceptable admission of those summaries and his summary reports as well. And then those summary reports would also fall under the business records exception because it's documenting their business decision.
Those, I think you're telling us those reports were compiled by Mr. Dugdale and they were authenticated by his affidavit.
That is correct. Lastly, we didn't touch on this in the earlier argument, but in our brief, just want to reiterate for the HCFLA claim that was dismissed early on by Judge Ott, that's the Healthcare Facilities Licensure Act claim that's addressed in the briefs. There is no express waiver at all like FIPA. So this shows when we're looking at both FIPA here and the HCFLA, FIPA has an express provision that says, yes, employees can sue the state under FIPA for a FIPA claim. The HCFLA contains no such express waiver, and an express waiver is required under the Riley case that this court had issued.
You're talking about a waiver of sovereign immunity.
That is correct. Yeah.
Is there any indication that the state was going to be exposed to a national origin discrimination claim beyond the doctor's membership in a protected class?
Yes.
What evidence?
Yeah, so it is in the record that Dr. Creamy had reported to Mr. Dugdale in his interview that he felt that Dr. Baker was discriminating against him based on his race. And he had also filed a prior NEOC charge well before this, also based on race. And so there was that indication. And there were other doctors, not in protected classes, this is also in the record, who were also delinquent on their records at times. And Dr. Baker was not insisting that they be fired. So we're looking at that comparator as well. Thank you for your time. If there's no other questions.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 1:41, Mr. Dahman.
May it please the court. So the order did not emerge. The authority for the order did not emerge. Regardless of the position of the person who purported to claim the order, there is no suggestion anywhere in the evidence that it was either authorized or issued. What Dr. Baker heard as a rumor doesn't count. She had legal duties. Those duties are written down and acted. They're the law, or they're the regulation of the hospital, or they're the bylaws of the medical committee, or they're in the job description of the medical director. There are genuine issues of material fact on that subject to try. As for the quality of the investigation, the investigator did not investigate the prior medical director by inquiring of him. He works there, senior psychiatrist. Didn't investigate by interviewing any of the other psychiatrists. Didn't distinguish between the fact that the two who are identified in the record were the worst offenders, the ones who did not or were not effectively trying to catch up, and the others were responding to Dr. Baker's whip, if you wish to call it that, to try to protect patients. He also didn't investigate by inquiring about the director of behavioral health, and there is no evidence in the record from an investigation by inquiry of the immediate superior of Dr. Baker. The trier of fact could decide this is not a very good investigation. There is no evidence that Dr. Karimi was going to sue the state. There is no evidence that Dr. Baker knew anything about it. There is no evidence that anything ever came up about what nation Dr. Karimi is from or whether it made the slightest bit of difference. He was a bad doctor. He wasn't taking care of his patients, and that's why his boss was on him. There is simply nothing in this record to substantiate a reason for terminating these two distinguished employees. They deserve a trial.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments in Baker Hesser versus Department of Health and Human Services. So, counsel, you are excused.